Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We're joined by veteran investigator, journalist, and co-founder of The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald. He joins us from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Glenn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
How do you discern the motives of individuals who are leaking dossiers that are filled with unverifiable or unverified allegations?
Well, I think we know the motive of the person in this case because we know that during the time that he was compiling this dossier, he was working and being paid as an opposition researcher, first for anti-Trump Republicans and then by Democratic Party operatives trying to help Hillary Clinton. So I think we know that what his motives were, which was to dig as much dirt up as possible and to discredit to the extent he could the candidacy of Donald Trump.
How many investigators would be working in a situation like this where you have a feeding frenzy in the middle of a campaign? I mean, it's certainly not all journalists, as you've described.
Exactly. I mean, it's very common for campaigns, obviously, to sort of use dirty tactics and dig up dirt on the people against whom they're running. They spend a lot of money on that. But what's so striking here is that we know we have an intelligence community that gets billions of dollars every single year, tens of billions, in fact, and they don't seem to have uncovered any of these allegations, or at least most of the allegations. And I think that ought to put a big question mark over what this private individual ended up claiming.
Why would the intelligence services brief anyone on a document that they describe as unverified?
It's a really good question, especially since this document is not. It's not like it just surfaced in the last week or two. It's been floating around for months. The individual who wrote it has been trying to persuade media outlets to publish it, and none of them would. Obviously, the intelligence community was well aware of it, and so all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they decide to declare this person credible and then brief the president on it and then tell CNN about it, knowing that that would make the document become public. And I think the key context is that there's very obvious open conflict, if not outright warfare, between the CIA on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other, over Trump's refusal to accept their conclusions about Russian hacking, over his criticism of them for having been wrong about Iraq. And this is the way the intelligence community gets back at people, is they can damage your reputation or harm you in other ways if you defy them.
But it also sets in motion a dynamic that's almost impossible to penetrate. I mean, you've got conservative talk radio saying that there's a huge giant conspiracy now going on with the mainstream media trying to, you know, take Trump down. I mean, it's blistering what they're saying on conservative talk radio. But then on the other hand, you've also got this obsessive attention being paid to anything that's bad about Donald Trump. It's as though this story has become the kind of lefty, college-educated, liberals version of the Kardashian story.
I couldn't agree more, and this is really what concerns me the most, which is the only way someone like Donald Trump and his acolytes and right-wing talk radio can convince people to dispense with their faith in established media institutions is if those institutions prove themselves unwarranting of that trust. So if they constantly disseminate claims for political reasons, such as harming Trump, without regard to whether or not they're true, Trump can then seize on that and say, look, these media outlets are producing fake news. So when they tell the world that Vladimir Putin invaded the U.S. electric grid and it turns out to be false, when they mindlessly endorse every CIA claim, notwithstanding the fact that there's no evidence, when they publish a document like this that's completely unvetted and that is in the process of being affirmatively disproven, that does end up helping the strategy of Trump and right-wing radio to discredit media organizations and convince people not to listen to them. And the more important issue is Donald Trump is doing a lot of bad things on a policy level that people care about. And Democrats are talking about almost none of that. They're obsessed with Vladimir Putin and Russia. If you look at what they question Trump's nominees on, it's Russia 24/7. And I just don't think people wake up in the morning, on average in America, worried about what the Kremlin is doing.
Would you say this is a fake news story in the classic sense of the word, in that, you know, blogs in Macedonia put forth some story that looks okay, that goes viral, and then people talk about it as though it's fact?
I think it has things in common with that. I think the classic fake news case of the Macedonian teenagers was something motivated almost exclusively by profit. They were just trying to get people to click on things so that they would get Facebook revenue. Whereas in this case, I think it's more political. The objective is to undermine Trump. Although in the case of BuzzFeed, I think the reason they ended up publishing that document, maybe they believed it was journalistically justifiable, but certainly they knew it would generate huge amounts of clicks, which it did, and therefore profit for BuzzFeed, where you see the motive veering into what Macedonian teenagers do. But I think
that's why BuzzFeed exists. That's what they do. I mean, we're in an era now where BuzzFeed will publish. The New York Times won't. They'll just, like, talk about it in the background. But BuzzFeed will publish something like that.
Exactly. And the CIA knew that when it did what it did, namely call this guy credible, brief Trump and Obama on it, and then go to CNN with it, they knew that somebody was going to step forward and publish this document that was completely predictable for exactly the reason that you just said. Now, the thing I would add, though, about in defense of BuzzFeed is not only does BuzzFeed do a lot of good investigative journalism, but in this case, I mean, once CNN comes and tells the country the CIA believes that Russia has dirt, incriminating dirt on Trump with which they're blackmailing him, I think it leaves then leads to all the speculation. What does Russia have? What did Trump do? And on some level, what BuzzFeed did in publishing that document was journalistically valuable in that it ended the speculation. It showed us exactly what CNN was talking about, and it enabled us to evaluate this document and see it for the joke that it was. So I don't think anybody should have published before that CNN report, but once CNN reported what they did, I think that the justification becomes more compelling for why the document should be shown rather than just talked about.
The political motives of the intelligence agencies have been, you know, well established since the famous slam dunk remark during the Iraq invasion on weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, well before that even. But why would the intelligence agencies declare war on Donald Trump before he's even inaugurated? How could they possibly win a battle like that, and what would be in it for them?
I think if you look at what has mattered to the CIA over the last 5 years and then compare Clinton's positions to Trump's positions with regard to those issues and priorities, it's clear why the CIA wanted Hillary Clinton to win and not only wanted Donald Trump to lose, but now want to weaken him. Probably their most important priority over the last 5 years as an agency was their proxy war in Syria, trying to fund rebels to facilitate regime change in Syria against Assad. Clinton wanted to expand that war, that CIA war, and was critical of Obama for not doing enough to support it. Trump, on the other hand, said, we have no reason to change the government in Syria. We have no business being involved there. We should let Russia and Assad run wild and kill ISIS, al-Qaeda, and anyone else they want. And over, even in terms of how much we should confront Russia, Clinton wanted to confront Moscow more, and the CIA hates the Russians. Trump was saying, let's have better relations. So I think we see that Trump is a real threat to the agenda and institutional priorities of the CIA, and it's not hard to understand why they wanted to defeat him and now wanted to weaken and undermine him.
Well, all of these rumors have a lot more meaning and context when you put it that way, and you see that really, we're talking about an impending serious change in policy and the various institutions that stand to lose there. So that makes a lot of sense. Finally, before we go, since you are the Snowden man, and Snowden is in Russia, and we've been talking so much about Russia as the new president takes office, where does the notion of government surveillance stand at the end of the Obama administration? And where do you think it's headed under this very new regime in Washington?
I think it's a huge cause for concern. Unfortunately, Democrats and liberals and progressives, with some exceptions, but by and large, generally cheered for Obama, or at least defended him as he built up the surveillance state. Even once we revealed it with the Snowden documents, a lot of Democrats played the leading role in protecting it from genuine reform. And as a result, this person, who is very likely has authoritarian tendencies, to put that mildly, is about to inherit this limitless surveillance state that can literally learn whatever it wants about any person, not just foreign national, but American citizens as well, with very few legal or judicial constraints. And I think it's an extremely serious concern that he's going to inherit this massive war on terror apparatus that George Bush and Dick Cheney built and Barack Obama protected and expanded.
Finally, before we go, Glenn, I mean, I sometimes worry about you because, you know, at various border crossings, there could be questions asked by U.S. officials. And so I understand why you're in Rio. It's also a nice place to be. But just assessing the level of government corruption in Brazil these days, any sense of contrast between Washington and Brazil in terms of government dysfunction and corruption?
Well, the funny thing is, I have been reporting on Brazil politics as well the last couple of years. And 6 months ago, I thought that nothing could ever be more unstable and crazy and insane than Brazilian politics. And yet now, in comparison to U.S. politics and even post-Brexit British politics, Brazilian politics seems stable and sane and tranquil by comparison. But the interesting thing about Brazil is that for as much turmoil as there has been, we have seen in Brazil the most powerful billionaires, the most influential political leaders, regardless of party or ideology, being carted off to prison for systemic corruption. And you compare that to the United States, where no Wall Street tycoons went to prison, people who tortured others were protected and immunized, and the rule of law was more or less suspended for those who are most powerful. And I think Brazil comes out looking pretty good when you compare them that way.
Great point. Glenn Greenwald is a co-founder of The Intercept. He spoke to us from Rio de Janeiro. Thank you so much, Glenn.
Great to be with you. Thanks.